results. With this end in view, it was proposed that the exclusive privilege of all maritime commerce should be secured to it, and an edict to that effect was published. But it was unfortunately forgotten that by such a measure all the merchants of the country would be ruined. The idea of such an immense privilege was generally scouted by the nation, and petition on petition was presented to the Parliament that they would refuse to register the decree. They refused accordingly, and the regent, remarking that they did nothing but fan the flame of sedition, exiled them to Blois. At the intercession of D'Aguesseau, the place of banishment was changed to Pontoise, and thither accordingly the councillors repaired, determined to set the regent at defiance. They made every arrangement for rendering their temporary exile as agreeable as possible. The president gave the most elegant suppers, to which he invited all the gayest and wittiest company of Paris. Every night there was a concert and ball for the ladies. The usually grave and solemn judges and counselors joined in cards and other diversions, leading for several weeks a life of the most extravagant pleasure, for no other purpose than to show the regent of how little consequence they deemed their banishment, and that when they willed it they could make Pontoise a pleasanter residence than Paris. Of all the nations in the world, the French are the most renowned for singing over their grievances. Of that country it has been remarked with some truth that its whole history may be traced in its songs. When Law, by the utter failure of his best-laid plans, rendered himself obnoxious, satire, of course, seized hold upon him. And while caricatures of his person appeared in all the shops, the streets resounded with songs, in which neither he nor the regent was spared. Many of these songs were far from decent, and one of them in particular counseled the application of all his notes to the most ignoble use to which paper can be applied. But the following, preserved in the letters of the Duchess of Orléans, was the best and the most popular, and was to be heard for months in all the Carrefour in Paris. The application of the chorus is happy enough. Aussitôt que l'as arriva dans notre bonne ville, Monsieur le Régent publia que l'as serait utile pour rétablir la nation. La faridondaine, la faridondon. Mais il nous a tous enrichis. Biribi, à la façon de Barbarie, mon ami. Ce parpaillot, pour attirer tout l'argent de la France, songea d'abord à s'assurer de notre confiance. Il fit son abjuration. La faridondaine, la faridondon. Mais le fourbe s'est converti. Biribi, à la façon de Barbarie, mon ami. L'as, le fils aîné de Satan, nous met tous à l'aumône, il nous a pris tout notre argent, et non rende à personne. Mais le régent, humain et bon, la faridondaine, la faridondon, nous rendra ce qu'on nous a pris, biribi, à la façon de Barbarie, mon ami. The following epigram is of the same date. Lundi, j'achetai des actions. Mardi, j'ai gagné des millions. Mercredi, je rangeai mon ménage. Jeudi, je pris un équipage. Vendredi, je m'en fous au bal. Et samedi, à l'hôpital. Among the caricatures that were abundantly published and that showed as plainly as graver matters that the nation had awakened to a sense of its folly, was one, a facsimile of which is preserved in the Mémoire de la Régence. It was thus described by its author. The goddess of shares in her triumphal car driven by the goddess of folly. Those who are drawing the car are impersonations of the Mississippi with his wooden leg, the South Sea, the Bank of England, the Company of the West of Senegal, and of various assurances. Lest the car should not roll fast enough, the agents of these companies, known by their long foxtails and their cunning looks, turn round the spokes of the wheels, upon which are marked the names of the several stocks and their value, sometimes high and sometimes low, according to the turns of the wheel. Upon the ground are the merchandise, day-books, and ledgers of legitimate commerce, crushed under the chariot of folly. Behind is an immense crowd of persons, of all ages, sexes, and conditions, clamoring after fortune and fighting with each other to get a portion of the shares which she distributes so bountifully among them. In the clouds sits a demon blowing bubbles of soap, which are also the objects of the admiration and cupidity of the crowd, who jump upon one another's backs to reach them ere they burst. Right in the pathway of the car and blocking up the passage stands a large building with three doors, through one of which it must pass if it proceeds farther, and all the crowd along with it. Over the first door are the words Hôpital des Fous, over the second Hôpital des Malades, and over the third Hôpital des Gueux. Another caricature represented Law sitting in a large cauldron, boiling over the flames of popular madness, surrounded by an impetuous multitude, who were pouring all their gold and silver into it, and receiving gladly in exchange the bits of paper which he distributed among them by handfuls. While this excitement lasted, Law took good care not to expose himself unguarded in the streets. Shut up in the apartments of the regent, he was secure from all attack. And whenever he ventured abroad, it was either incognito or in one of the royal carriages with a powerful escort. An amusing anecdote is recorded of the detestation in which he was held by the people, and the ill treatment he would have met had he fallen into their hands. A gentleman of the name of Bourcel was passing in his carriage down the Rue Saint-Antoine, when his farther progress was stayed by a hackney coach that had blocked up the road. Monsieur Bourcel's servant called impatiently to the hackney coachman to get out of the way, and on his refusal struck him a blow on the face. A crowd was soon drawn together by the disturbance, and Monsieur Bourcel got out of the carriage to restore order. The hackney coachman, imagining that he had now another assailant, bethought him of an expedient to rid himself of both, and called out as loudly as he was able, "Help! Help! Murder! Murder! Here are Law and his servant going to kill me! Help! Help!" At this cry the people came out of their shops, armed with sticks and other weapons, while the mob gathered stones to inflict summary vengeance upon the supposed financier. Happily for Monsieur Bourcel and his servant, the door of the Church of the Jesuits stood wide open, and seeing the fearful odds against them, they rushed towards it with all speed. They reached the altar, pursued by the people, and would have been ill-treated even there if, finding the door open leading to the sacristy, they had not sprang through and closed it after them. The mob were then persuaded to leave the church by the alarmed and indignant priests, and finding Monsieur Bourcel's carriage still in the streets, they vented their ill will against it and did it considerable damage. The 25 millions secured on the municipal revenues of the city of Paris, bearing so low an interest as 2.5%, were not very popular among the large holders of Mississippi stock. The conversion of the securities was, therefore, a work of considerable difficulty, for many preferred to retain the falling paper of Law's company in the hope that a favorable turn might take place. On the 15th of August, with a view to hasten the conversion, an edict was passed declaring that all notes for sums between 1,000 and 10,000 livres should not pass current, except for the purchase of annuities and bank accounts, or for the payment of installments still due on the shares of the company. In October following, another edict was passed, depriving these notes of all value whatever after the month of November next ensuing. The management of the mint, the farming of the revenue, and all the other advantages and privileges of the India or Mississippi Company were taken from them, and they were reduced to a mere private company. This was a death blow to the whole system, which had now got into the hands of its enemies. Law had lost all influence in the Council of Finance, and the company, being despoiled of its immunities, could no longer hold out the shadow of a prospect of being able to fulfill its engagements. All those suspected of illegal profits at the time the public delusion was at its height were sought out and immersed in heavy fines. It was previously ordered that a list of the original proprietors should be made out and that such persons as still retained their shares should place them in deposit with the company, and that those who had neglected to complete the shares for which they had put down their names should now purchase them of the company at the rate of 13,500 livres for each share of 500 livres. Rather than submit to pay this enormous sum for stock which was actually at a discount, The shareholders packed up all their portable effects and endeavored to find a refuge in foreign countries. Orders were immediately issued to the authorities at the ports and frontiers to apprehend all travelers who sought to leave the kingdom and keep them in custody until it was ascertained whether they had any plate or jewelry with them or were concerned in the late stock jobbing. Against such few as escaped, the punishment of death was recorded, while the most arbitrary proceedings were instituted against those who remained. Law himself, in a moment of despair, determined to leave a country where his life was no longer secure. He at first only demanded permission to retire from Paris to one of his country seats, a permission which the regent cheerfully granted. The latter was much affected at the unhappy turn affairs had taken, but his faith continued unmoved in the truth and efficacy of Law's financial system. His eyes were opened to his own errors, and during the few remaining years of his life, he constantly longed for an opportunity of again establishing the system upon a securer basis. At Law's last interview with the prince, he is reported to have said, "I confess that I have committed many faults. I committed them because I am a man, and all men are liable to error. But I declare to you most solemnly that none of them proceeded from wicked or dishonest motives, and that nothing of the kind will be found in the whole course of my conduct." 2 or 3 days after his departure, the regent sent him a very kind letter, permitting him to leave the kingdom whenever he pleased, and stating that he had ordered his passports to be made ready. He at the same time offered him any sum of money he might require. Law respectfully declined the money and set out for Brussels in a postchaise belonging to Madame de Prie, the mistress of the Duke of Bourbon, escorted by 6 horse guards. From thence he proceeded to Venice, where he remained for some months, the object of the greatest curiosity to the people who believed him to be the possessor of enormous wealth. No opinion, however, could be more erroneous. With more generosity than could have been expected from a man who, during the greatest part of his life, had been a professed gambler, he had refused to enrich himself at the expense of a ruined nation. During the height of the popular frenzy for Mississippi stock, he had never doubted of the final success of his projects in making France the richest and most powerful nation of Europe. He invested all his gains in the purchase of landed property in France, a sure proof of his own belief in the stability of his schemes. He had hoarded no plate or jewelry and sent no money, like the dishonest jobbers, to foreign countries. His all, with the exception of 1 diamond worth about 5,000 or 6,000 pounds sterling, was invested in the French soil, and when he left that country, he left it almost a beggar. This fact alone ought to rescue his memory from the charge of knavery, so often and so unjustly brought against him. As soon as his departure was known, all his estates and his valuable library were confiscated. Among the rest, an annuity of 200,000 livres, £8,000 sterling, on the lives of his wife and children, which had been purchased for 5 millions of livres, was forfeited, notwithstanding that a special edict drawn up for the purpose in the days of his prosperity had expressly declared that it should never be confiscated for any cause whatever. Great discontent existed among the people that Law had been suffered to escape. The mob and the parliament would have been pleased to have seen him hanged. The few who had not suffered by the commercial revolution rejoiced that the quack had left the country. But all those, and they were by far the most numerous class, whose fortunes were implicated, regretted that his intimate knowledge of the distress of the country and of the causes that had led to it had not been rendered more available in discovering a remedy. At a meeting of the Council of Finance and the General Council of the Regency, documents were laid upon the table from which it appeared that the amount of notes in circulation was 2,700 millions. The regent was called upon to explain how it happened that there was a discrepancy between the dates at which these issues were made and those of the edicts by which they were authorized. He might have safely taken the whole blame upon himself, but he preferred that an absent man should bear a share of it. And he therefore stated that Law, upon his own authority, had issued 1,200 millions of notes at different times, and that he, the regent, seeing that the thing had been irrevocably done, had screened Law by antedating the decrees of the council which authorized the augmentation. It would have been more to his credit if he had told the whole truth while he was about it, and acknowledged that it was mainly through his extravagance and impatience that Law had been induced to overstep the bounds of safe speculation. It was also ascertained that the national debt on the 1st of January 1721 amounted to upwards of 3,100 millions of livres, or more than 124 million pounds sterling, the interest upon which was 3,196,000 pounds sterling. A commission, or visa, was forthwith appointed to examine into all the securities of the state creditors, who were to be divided into five classes, the first four comprising those who had purchased their securities with real effects, and the latter comprising those who could give no proofs that the transactions they had entered into were real and bona fide. The securities of the latter were ordered to be destroyed, while those of the first four classes were subjected to a most rigid and jealous scrutiny. The result of the labors of the visa was a report in which they counseled the reduction of the interest upon these securities to 56 millions of livres. They justified this advice by a statement of the various acts of peculation and extortion which they had discovered, and an edict to that effect was accordingly published and duly registered by the parliaments of the kingdom. Another tribunal was afterwards established under the title of the Chambre de l'Arsenal, which took cognizance of the malversations committed in the financial departments of the government during the late unhappy period. A master of requests named Falonet, together with the Abbé Clément, and two clerks in their employ, had been concerned in divers acts of peculation to the amount of upwards of 1 million of livres. The first two were sentenced to be beheaded, and the latter to be hanged, but their punishment was afterwards commuted into imprisonment for life in the Bastille. Numerous other acts of dishonesty were discovered and punished by fine and imprisonment. D'Argenson shared with Law and the regent the unpopularity which had alighted upon all those concerned in the Mississippi madness. He was dismissed from his post of chancellor to make room for D'Aguesseau, but he retained the title of Keeper of the Seals and was allowed to attend the councils whenever he pleased. He thought it better, however, to withdraw from Paris and live for a time a life of seclusion at his country seat. But he was not formed for retirement, and becoming moody and discontented, he aggravated a disease under which he had long labored and died in less than a twelvemonth. The populace of Paris so detested him that they carried their hatred even to his grave. As his funeral procession passed to the church of Saint-Nicolas du Chardonneret, the burying place of his family, it was beset by a riotous mob, and his two sons, who were following as chief mourners, were obliged to drive as fast as they were able down a by-street to escape personal violence. As regards Law, he for some time entertained a hope that he should be recalled to France to aid in establishing its credit upon a firmer basis. The death of the regent in 1723, who expired suddenly as he was sitting by the fireside conversing with his mistress, the Duchess de Falary, deprived him of that hope, and he was reduced to lead his former life of gambling. He was more than once obliged to pawn his diamond, the sole remnant of his vast wealth, but successful play generally enabled him to redeem it. Being persecuted by his creditors at Rome, he proceeded to Copenhagen, where he received permission from the English ministry to reside in his native country, his pardon for the murder of Mr. Wilson having been sent over to him in 1719. He was brought over in the Admiral's ship, a circumstance which gave occasion for a short debate in the House of Lords. Earl Coningsby complained that a man who had renounced both his country and his religion should have been treated with such honor, and expressed his belief that his presence in England at a time when the people were so bewildered by the nefarious practices of the South Sea directors would be attended with no little danger. He gave notice of a motion on the subject, but it was allowed to drop, no other member of the House having the slightest participation in his lordship's fears. Law remained for about 4 years in England and then proceeded to Venice, where he died in 1729 in very embarrassed circumstances. The following epitaph was written at the time: Si j'y cet écossais célèbre, ce calculateur sans égal, qui, par les règles d'algèbre, a mis la France à l'hôpital. His brother, William Law, who had been concerned with him in the administration both of the bank and the Louisiana Company, was imprisoned in the Bastille for alleged malversation, but no guilt was ever proved against him. He was liberated after 15 months and became the founder of a family, which is still known in France under the title of Marquesses of Lauriston. In the next chapter will be found an account of the madness which infected the people of England at the same time, and under very similar circumstances, but which, thanks to the energies and good sense of a constitutional government, was attended with results far less disastrous than those which were seen in France. The South Sea Bubble. At length corruption, like a general flood, did deluge all, and avarice creeping on, spread like a low-born mist and hid the sun. Statesmen and patriots plied alike the stocks, peerless and butler shared alike the box, and judges jobbed and bishops bit the town, and mighty dukes packed cards for half a crown. Britain was sunk in lucre's sordid charms. Pope. The South Sea Company was originated by the celebrated Harley, Earl of Oxford, in the year 1711, with the view of restoring public credit, which had suffered by the dismissal of the Whig ministry, and of providing for the discharge of the army and navy debentures and other parts of the floating debt, amounting to nearly 10 millions sterling. A company of merchants, at that time without a name, took this debt upon themselves, and the government agreed to secure them for a certain period the interest of 6%. To provide for this interest, amounting to £600,000 per annum, the duties upon wines, vinegar, India goods, wrought silks, tobacco, whale fins, and some other articles were rendered permanent. The monopoly of the trade to the South Seas was granted, and the company, being incorporated by Act of Parliament, assumed the title by which it has ever since been known. The minister took great credit to himself for his share in this transaction, and the scheme was always called by his flatterers the Earl of Oxford's masterpiece. Even at this early period of its history, the most visionary ideas were formed by the company and the public of the immense riches of the eastern coast of South America. Everybody had heard of the gold and silver mines of Peru and Mexico. Everyone believed them to be inexhaustible, and that it was only necessary to send the manufactures of England to the coast to be repaid 100-fold in gold and silver ingots by the natives. A report industriously spread that Spain was willing to concede 4 ports on the coasts of Chile and Peru for the purposes of traffic, increased the general confidence, and for many years the South Sea Company's stock was in high favor. Philip V of Spain, however, never had any intention of admitting the English to a free trade in the ports of Spanish America. Negotiations were set on foot, but their only result was the Asiento contract, or the privilege of supplying the colonies with Negroes for 30 years, and of sending once a year a vessel, limited both as to tonnage and value of cargo, to trade with Mexico, Peru, or Chile. The latter permission was only granted upon the hard condition that the King of Spain should enjoy 1/4 of the profits, and a tax of 5% on the remainder. This was a great disappointment to the Earl of Oxford and his party, who were reminded much oftener than they found agreeable of the parturiunt montes, nascitur ridiculus mus. But the public confidence in the South Sea Company was not shaken. The Earl of Oxford declared that Spain would permit 2 ships, in addition to the annual ship, to carry out merchandise during the first year, and a list was published in which all the ports and harbors of these coasts were pompously set forth as open to the trade of Great Britain. The first voyage of the annual ship was not made till the year 1717, and in the following year the trade was suppressed by the rupture with Spain. The King's speech at the opening of the session of 1717 made pointed allusion to the state of public credit, and recommended that proper measures should be taken to reduce the national debt. The 2 great monetary corporations, the South Sea Company and the Bank of England, made proposals to Parliament on the 20th of May ensuing. The South Sea Company prayed that their capital stock of 10 millions might be increased to 12, by subscription or otherwise, and offered to accept 5% instead of 6 upon the whole amount. The bank made proposals equally advantageous. The House debated for some time, and finally three acts were passed, called the South Sea Act, the Bank Act, and the General Fund Act. By the first, the proposals of the South Sea Company were accepted, and that body held itself ready to advance the sum of $2 million towards discharging the principal and interest of the debt due by the state for the four lottery funds of the 9th and 10th years of Queen Anne. By the second act, the bank received a lower rate of interest for the sum of £1,775,027.15 due to it by the state, and agreed to deliver up to be cancelled as many exchequer bills as amounted to £2 million, and to accept of an annuity of £100,000, being after the rate of 5%, the whole redeemable at 1 year's notice. They were further required to be ready to advance, in case of need, a sum not exceeding £2,500,000, upon the same terms of 5% interest, redeemable by Parliament. The General Fund Act recited the various deficiencies which were to be made good by the aids derived from the foregoing sources. The name of the South Sea Company was thus continually before the public. Though their trade with the South American states produced little or no augmentation of their revenues, they continued to flourish as a monetary corporation. Their stock was in high request, and the directors, buoyed up with success, began to think of new means for extending their influence. The Mississippi scheme of John Law, which so dazzled and captivated the French people, inspired them with an idea that they could carry on the same game in England. The anticipated failure of his plans did not divert them from their intention. Wise in their own conceit, they imagined they could avoid his faults, carry on their schemes forever, and stretch the cord of credit to its extremest tension without causing it to snap asunder. It was while Law's plan was at its greatest height of popularity, while people were crowding in thousands to the Rue Quincampoix and ruining themselves with frantic eagerness, that the South Sea directors laid before Parliament their famous plan for paying off the national debt. Visions of boundless wealth floated before the fascinated eyes of the people in the two most celebrated countries of Europe. The English commenced their career of extravagance somewhat later than the French, but as soon as the delirium seized them, they were determined not to be outdone. Upon the 22nd of January 1720, the House of Commons resolved itself into a committee of the whole House to take into consideration that part of the King's speech at the opening of the session which related to the public debts, and the proposal of the South Sea Company towards the redemption and sinking of the same. The proposal set forth at great length, and under several heads, the debts of the state, amounting to £30,981,712, which the company were anxious to take upon themselves, upon consideration of 5% per annum secured to them until midsummer 1727, after which time the whole was to become redeemable at the pleasure of the legislature, and the interest to be reduced to 4%. The proposal was received with great favor, but the Bank of England had many friends in the House of Commons who were desirous that that body should share in the advantages that were likely to accrue. On behalf of this corporation, it was represented that they had performed great and eminent services to the state in the most difficult times, and deserved at least that if any advantage was to be made by public bargains of this nature, they should be preferred before a company that had never done anything for the nation. The further consideration of the matter was accordingly postponed for 5 days. In the meantime, a plan was drawn up by the governors of the bank. The South Sea Company, afraid that the bank might offer still more advantageous terms to the government than themselves, reconsidered their former proposal and made some alterations in it, which they hoped would render it more acceptable. The principal change was a stipulation that the government might redeem these debts at the expiration of 4 years instead of 7, as at first suggested. The bank resolved not to be outbidden in this singular auction, and the governors also reconsidered their first proposal and sent in a new one. Thus, each corporation having made two proposals, the House began to deliberate. Mr. Robert Walpole was the chief speaker in favor of the bank, and Mr. Aislabie, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the principal advocate on behalf of the South Sea Company. It was resolved on the 2nd of February that the proposals of the latter were most advantageous to the country. They were accordingly received, and leave was given to bring in a bill to that effect. Exchange Alley was in a fever of excitement. The company's stock, which had been at 130 the previous day, gradually rose to 300, and continued to rise with the most astonishing rapidity during the whole time that the bill in its several stages was under discussion. Mr. Walpole was almost the only statesman in the House who spoke out boldly against it. He warned them in eloquent and solemn language of the evils that would ensue. It countenanced, he said, the dangerous practice of stock-jobbing and would divert the genius of the nation from trade and industry. It would hold out a dangerous lure to decoy the unwary to their ruin by making them part with the earnings of their labor for a prospect of imaginary wealth. The great principle of the project was an evil of first-rate magnitude. It was to raise artificially the value of the stock by exciting and keeping up a general infatuation, and by promising dividends out of funds which could never be adequate to the purpose. In a prophetic spirit, he added that if the plan succeeded, the directors would become masters of the government, form a new and absolute aristocracy in the kingdom, and control the resolutions of the legislature. If it failed, which he was convinced it would, the result would bring general discontent and ruin upon the country. Such would be the delusion that when the evil day came, as come it would, the people would start up as from a dream, and ask themselves if these things could have been true. All his eloquence was in vain. He was looked upon as a false prophet, or compared to the hoarse raven, croaking omens of evil. His friends, however, compared him to Cassandra, predicting evils which would only be believed when they came home to men's hearths, and stared them in the face at their own boards. Although in former times the House had listened with the utmost attention to every word that fell from his lips, the benches became deserted when it was known that he would speak on the South Sea question. The bill was 2 months in its progress through the House of Commons. During this time, every exertion was made by the directors and their friends, and more especially by the chairman, the noted Sir John Blunt, to raise the price of the stock. The most extravagant rumors were in circulation. Treaties between England and Spain were spoken of, whereby the latter was to grant a free trade to all her colonies, and the rich produce of the mines of Potosi La Paz was to be brought to England until silver should become almost as plentiful as iron. For cotton and woolen goods, with which we could supply them in abundance, the dwellers in Mexico's were to empty their golden mines. The company of merchants trading to the South Seas would be the richest the world ever saw, and every £100 invested in it would produce hundreds per annum to the stockholder. At last the stock was raised by these means to near 400, but after fluctuating a good deal settled at 330, at which price it remained when the bill passed the Commons by a majority of 172 against 55. In the House of Lords, the bill was hurried through all its stages with unexampled rapidity. On the 4th of April, it was read a first time. On the 5th, it was read a second time. On the 6th, it was committed. And on the 7th, was read a third time and passed. Several peers spoke warmly against the scheme, but their warnings fell upon dull, cold ears. A speculating frenzy had seized them as well as the plebeians. Lord North and Grey said the bill was unjust in its nature and might prove fatal in its consequences, being calculated to enrich the few and impoverish the many. The Duke of Wharton followed, but as he only retailed at second hand the arguments so eloquently stated by Walpole in the lower house, he was not listened to with even the same attention that had been bestowed upon Lord North and Grey. Earl Cooper followed on the same side and compared the bill to the famous horse of the Siege of Troy. Like that, it was ushered in and received with great pomp and acclamations of joy, but bore within it treachery and destruction. The Earl of Sunderland endeavored to answer all objections, and on the question being put, there appeared only 17 peers against, and 83 in favor of the project. The very same day on which it passed the Lords, it received the royal assent and became the law of the land. It seemed at that time as if the whole nation had turned stock-jobbers. Exchange Alley was every day blocked up by crowds, and Cornhill was impassable for the number of carriages. Everybody came to purchase stock. Every fool aspired to be a knave, in the words of a ballad published at the time and sung about the streets. Then stars and garters did appear among the meaner rabble, to buy and sell, to see and hear the Jews and Gentiles squabble. The greatest ladies thither came and plied in chariots daily, or pawned their jewels for a sum to venture in the alley. The inordinate thirst of gain that had afflicted all ranks of society was not to be slaked, even in the South Sea. Other schemes of the most extravagant kind were started. The share lists were speedily filled up, and an enormous traffic carried on in shares, while, of course, every means were resorted to raise them to an artificial value in the market. Contrary to all expectation, South Sea stock fell when the bill received the royal assent. On the 7th of April, the shares were quoted at 310, and on the following day at 290. Already the directors had tasted the profits of their scheme, and it was not likely that they should quietly allow the stock to find its natural level without an effort to raise it. Immediately their busy emissaries were set to work. Every person interested in the success of the project endeavored to draw a knot of listeners around him, to whom he expatiated on the treasures of the South American seas. Exchange Alley was crowded with attentive groups. One rumor alone, asserted with the utmost confidence, had an immediate effect upon the stock. It was said that Earl Stanhope had received overtures in France from the Spanish government to exchange Gibraltar and Port Mahon for some places on the coast of Peru, for the security and enlargement of the trade in the South Seas. Instead of one annual ship trading to those ports, and allowing the King of Spain 25% out of the profits, the company might build and charter as many ships as they pleased, and pay no percentage whatever to any foreign potentate. Visions of ingots danced before their eyes, and stock rose rapidly. On the 12th of April, 5 days after the bill had become law, the directors opened their books for a subscription of 1 million at the rate of £300 for every £100 capital. Such was the concourse of persons of all ranks that this first subscription was found to amount to above 2 millions of original stock. It was to be paid at 5 payments of £60 each for every £100. In a few days, the stock advanced to 340, and the subscriptions were sold for double the price of the first payment. To raise the stock still higher, it was declared in a general court of directors on the 21st of April that the midsummer dividend should be 10% and that all subscriptions should be entitled to the same. These resolutions answering the end designed, the directors, to improve the infatuation of the moneyed men, opened their books for a second subscription of 1 million at 400%. Such was the frantic eagerness of people of every class to speculate in these funds that in the course of a few hours, no less than 1.5 million was subscribed at that rate. In the meantime, innumerable joint stock companies started up everywhere. They soon received the name of bubbles, the most appropriate that imagination could devise. The populace are often most happy in the nicknames they employ. None could be more apt than that of bubbles. Some of them lasted for a week or a fortnight and were no more heard of, while others could not even live out that short span of existence. Every evening produced new schemes and every morning new projects. The highest of the aristocracy were as eager in this hot pursuit of gain as the most plodding jobber in Cornhill. The Prince of Wales became governor of one company and is said to have cleared £40,000 by his speculations. The Duke of Bridgewater started a scheme for the improvement of London and Westminster, and the Duke of Chandos another. There were nearly 100 different projects, each more extravagant and deceptive than the other. To use the words of the political state, they were set on foot and promoted by crafty knaves, then pursued by multitudes of covetous fools, and at last appeared to be, in effect, what their vulgar appellation denoted them to be. Bubbles and mere cheats. It was computed that near 1.5 million sterling was won and lost by these unwarrantable practices to the impoverishment of many a fool and the enriching of many a rogue. Some of these schemes were plausible enough, and had they been undertaken at a time when the public mind was unexcited, might have been pursued with advantage to all concerned. But they were established merely with the view of raising the shares in the market. The projectors took the opportunity of a rise to sell out, and next morning the scheme was at an end. Maitland, in his History of London, gravely informs us that one of the projects which received great encouragement was for the establishment of a company to make deal boards out of sawdust. This is no doubt intended as a joke, but there is abundance of evidence to show that dozens of schemes, hardly a whit more reasonable, lived their little day, ruining hundreds ere they fell. One of them was for a wheel for perpetual motion, capital 1 million. Another was for encouraging the breed of horses in England, and improving of glebe and church lands, and repairing and rebuilding parsonage and vicarage houses. Why the clergy, who were so mainly interested in the latter clause, should have taken so much interest in the first is only to be explained on the supposition that the scheme was projected by a knot of the fox-hunting parsons, once so common in England. The shares of this company were rapidly subscribed for, but the most absurd and preposterous of all, and which showed more completely than any other the utter madness of the people, was one started by an unknown adventurer entitled "A Company for Carrying on an Undertaking of Great Advantage, but Nobody to Know What It Is." Were not the fact stated by scores of credible witnesses, it would be impossible to believe that any person could have been duped by such a project. The man of genius who essayed this bold and successful inroad upon public credulity merely stated in his prospectus that the required capital was 500,000, in 5,000 shares of £100 each, deposit £2 per share. Each subscriber paying his deposit would be entitled to £100 per annum per share. How this immense profit was to be obtained, he did not condescend to inform them at that time, but promised that in a month full particulars should be duly announced, and a call made for the remaining £98 of the subscription. Next morning at 9 o'clock, this great man opened an office in Cornhill. Crowds of people beset his door, and when he shut up at 3 o'clock, he found that no less than 1,000 shares had been subscribed for, and the deposits paid. He was thus, in 5 hours, the winner of £2,000. He was philosopher enough to be contented with his venture, and set off the same evening for the Continent. He was never heard of again. Well might Swift exclaim, comparing Change Alley to a gulf in the South Sea, "Subscribers here by thousands float, and jostle one another down, each paddling in his leaky boat, and here they fish for gold and drown. Now buried in the depths below, now mounted up to heaven again, they reel and stagger to and fro, at their wits' end, like drunken men. Meantime, secure on Garraway cliffs, a savage race, by shipwrecks fed, lie waiting for the foundered skiffs, and strip the bodies of the dead." Another fraud that was very successful was that of the globe permits, as they were called. They were nothing more than square pieces of playing cards, on which was the impression of a seal, in wax, bearing the sign of the Globe Tavern, in the neighborhood of Exchange Alley, with the inscription of "Sailcloth Permits." The possessors enjoyed no other advantage from them than permission to subscribe at some future time to a new sailcloth manufactory, projected by one who was then known to be a man of fortune, but who was afterwards involved in the peculation and punishment of the South Sea directors. These permits sold for as much as 60 guineas in the alley. Persons of distinction, of both sexes, were deeply engaged in all these bubbles, those of the male sex going to taverns and coffee houses to meet their brokers, and the ladies resorting for the same purpose to the shops of milliners and haberdashers. But it did not follow that all these people believed in the feasibility of the schemes to which they subscribed. It was enough for their purpose that their shares would, by stock-jobbing arts, be soon raised to a premium when they got rid of them with all expedition to the really credulous. So great was the confusion of the crowd in the alley that shares in the same bubble were known to have been sold at the same instant 10% higher at one end of the alley than at the other. Sensible men beheld the extraordinary infatuation of the people with sorrow and alarm. There were some both in and out of Parliament who foresaw clearly the ruin that was impending. Mr. Walpole did not cease his gloomy forebodings. His fears were shared by all the thinking few and impressed most forcibly upon the government. On the 11th of June, the day the Parliament rose, the King published a proclamation declaring that all these unlawful projects should be deemed public nuisances and prosecuted accordingly, and forbidding any broker under a penalty of £500 from buying or selling any shares in them. Notwithstanding this proclamation, roguish speculators still carried them on, and the deluded people still encouraged them. On the 12th of July, an order of the Lords Justices assembled in Privy Council was published, dismissing all the petitions that had been presented for patents and charters, and dissolving all the bubble companies. Besides these bubbles, many others sprang up daily, in spite of the condemnation of the government and the ridicule of the still sane portion of the public. The print shops teemed with caricatures, and the newspapers with epigrams and satires upon the prevalent folly. An ingenious card maker published a pack of South Sea playing cards, which are now extremely rare, each card containing, besides the usual figures, of a very small size, in one corner, a caricature of a bubble company, with appropriate verses underneath. One of the most famous bubbles was Puckle's Machine Company, for discharging round and square cannonballs and bullets, and making a total revolution in the art of war. Its pretensions to public favor were thus summed up on the Eight of Spades. A rare invention to destroy the crowd of fools at home instead of fools abroad. Fear not, my friends, this terrible machine. They're only wounded who have shares therein. The Nine of Hearts was a caricature of the English Copper and Brass Company with the following epigram. The headlong fool that wants to be a swapper of gold and silver coin for English copper may, in Change Alley, prove himself an ass and give rich metal for adulterate brass. The Eight of Diamonds celebrated the company for the colonization of Acadia with this doggerel. He that is rich and wants to fool away a good round sum in North America, let him subscribe himself a headlong sharer, and ass's ears shall honor him or bearer. And in a similar style, every card of the pack exposed some knavish scheme and ridiculed the persons who were its dupes. It was computed that the total amount of the sums proposed for carrying on these projects was upwards of 300 millions sterling. It is time, however, to return to the great South Sea Gulf that swallowed the fortunes of so many thousands of the avaricious and the credulous. On the 29th of May, the stock had risen as high as 500, and about two-thirds of the government annuitants had exchanged the securities of the state for those of the South Sea Company. During the whole month of May, the stock continued to rise, and on the 28th it was quoted at 550. In 4 days after this, it took a prodigious leap, rising suddenly from 550 to 890. It was now the general opinion that the stock could rise no higher, and many persons took that opportunity of selling out, with a view of realizing their profits. Many noblemen and persons in the train of the king and about to accompany him to Hanover were also anxious to sell out. So many sellers and so few buyers appeared in the alley on the 3rd of June that the stock fell at once from 890 to 640. The directors were alarmed and gave their agents orders to buy. Their efforts succeeded. Towards evening, confidence was restored and the stock advanced to 750. It continued at this price, with some slight fluctuation, until the company closed their books on the 22nd of June. It would be needless and uninteresting to detail the various arts employed by the directors to keep up the price of stock. It will be sufficient to state that it finally rose to 1,000%. It was quoted at this price in the commencement of August. The bubble was then full-blown and began to quiver and shake, preparatory to its bursting. Many of the government annuitants expressed dissatisfaction against the directors. They accused them of partiality in making out the lists for shares in each subscription. Further uneasiness was occasioned by its being generally known that Sir John Blunt, the chairman, and some others had sold out. During the whole of the month of August, the stock fell, and on the 2nd of September it was quoted at 700 only. The state of things now became alarming. To prevent, if possible, the utter extinction of public confidence in their proceedings, the directors summoned a general court of the whole corporation to meet in Merchant Taylor's Hall on the 8th of September. By 9 o'clock in the morning, the room was filled to suffocation. Cheapside was blocked up by a crowd unable to gain admittance, and the greatest excitement prevailed. The directors and their friends mustered in great numbers. Sir John Fellowes, the sub-governor, was called to the chair. He acquainted the assembly with the cause of their meeting, read to them the several resolutions of the court of directors, and gave them an account of their proceedings, of the taking in the redeemable and unredeemable funds, and of the subscriptions in money. Mr. Secretary Craggs then made a short speech, wherein he commended the conduct of the directors, and urged that nothing could more effectually contribute to the bringing this scheme to perfection than union among themselves. He concluded with a motion for thanking the Court of Directors for their prudent and skillful management, and for desiring them to proceed in such manner as they should think most proper for the interest and advantage of the corporation. Mr. Hungerford, who had rendered himself very conspicuous in the House of Commons for his zeal in behalf of the South Sea Company, and who was shrewdly suspected to have been a considerable gainer by knowing the right time to sell out, was very magniloquent on this occasion. He said that he had seen the rise and fall, the decay and resurrection of many communities of this nature, but that in his opinion none had ever performed such wonderful things in so short a time as the South Sea Company. They had done more than the crown, the pulpit, or the bench could do. They had reconciled all parties in one common interest. They had laid asleep, if not wholly extinguished, all the domestic jars and animosities of the nation. By the rise of their stock, moneyed men had vastly increased their fortunes. Country gentlemen had seen the value of their lands doubled and trebled in their hands. They had at the same time done good to the church, not a few of the reverend clergy having got great sums by the project. In short, they had enriched the whole nation, and he hoped they had not forgotten themselves. There was some hissing at the latter part of this speech, which for the extravagance of its eulogy was not far removed from satire. But the directors and their friends and all the winners in the room applauded vehemently. The Duke of Portland spoke in a similar strain and expressed his great wonder why anybody should be dissatisfied. Of course, he was a winner by his speculations, and in a condition similar to that of the fat alderman in Joe Miller's jests, who, whenever he had eaten a good dinner, folded his hands upon his paunch and expressed his doubts whether there could be a hungry man in the world. Several resolutions were passed at this meeting, but they had no effect upon the public. Upon the very same evening the stock fell to 640, and on the morrow to 540. Day after day it continued to fall, until it was as low as 400. In a letter dated September 13th from Mr. Broderick, M.P., to Lord Chancellor Middleton, and published in Cox's Walpole, the former says, "Various are the conjectures why the South Sea directors have suffered the cloud to break so early. I made no doubt but they would do so when they found it to their advantage. They have stretched credit so far beyond what it would bear that specie proves insufficient to support it. Their most considerable men have drawn out, securing themselves by the losses of the deluded, thoughtless numbers, whose understandings have been overruled by avarice and the hope of making mountains out of molehills. Thousands of families will be reduced to beggary. The consternation is inexpressible. The rage beyond description, and the case altogether so desperate that I do not see any plan or scheme so much as thought of for averting the blow, so that I cannot pretend to guess what is next to be done." 10 days afterwards, the stock still falling, he writes, "The company have yet come to no determination, for they are in such a wood that they know not which way to turn. By several gentlemen lately come to town, I perceive the very name of a South Seaman grows abominable in every country. A great many goldsmiths are already run off, and more will daily. I question whether one-third, nay one-fourth of them, can stand it. From the very beginning I founded my judgment of the whole affair upon the unquestionable maxim that 10 millions, which is more than our running cash, could not circulate 200 millions. Beyond which our paper credit extended. That therefore, Whenever that should become doubtful, be the cause what it would, our noble state machine must inevitably fall to the ground. On the 12th of September, at the earnest solicitation of Mr. Secretary Craggs, several conferences were held between the directors of the South Sea and the directors of the bank. A report which was circulated, that the latter had agreed to circulate 6 millions of the South Sea Company's bonds, caused the stock to rise to 670. But in the afternoon, as soon as the report was known to be groundless, the stock fell again to 580, the next day to 570, and so gradually to 400. Gay, the poet, in that disastrous year, had a present from young Craggs of some South Sea stock, and once supposed himself to be master of £20,000. His friends persuaded him to sell his share, but he dreamed of dignity and splendor, and could not hear to obstruct his own fortune. He was then importuned to sell as much as would purchase 100 a year for life, which, says Fenton, will make you sure of a clean shirt and a shoulder of mutton every day. This counsel was rejected, the profit and principal were lost, and Gay sunk under the calamity so low that his life became in danger. Johnson's Lives of the Poets. The ministry were seriously alarmed at the aspect of affairs. The directors could not appear in the streets without being insulted. Dangerous riots were at every moment apprehended. Dispatches were sent off to the king at Hanover, praying his immediate return. Mr. Walpole, who was staying at his country seat, was sent for, that he might employ his known influence with the directors of the Bank of England to induce them to accept the proposal made by the South Sea Company for circulating a number of their bonds. The bank was very unwilling to mix itself up with the affairs of the company. It dreaded being involved in calamities which it could not relieve, and received all overtures with visible reluctance. But the universal voice of the nation called upon it to come to the rescue. Every person of note in commercial politics was called in to advise in the emergency. A rough draft of a contract drawn up by Mr. Walpole was ultimately adopted as the basis of further negotiations, and the public alarm abated a little. On the following day, the 20th of September, a general court of the South Sea Company was held at Merchant Taylor's Hall, in which resolutions were carried, empowering the directors to agree with the Bank of England or any other persons to circulate the company's bonds or make any other agreement with the bank which they should think proper. One of the speakers, a Mr. Pulteney, said it was most surprising to see the extraordinary panic which had seized upon the people. Men were running to and fro in alarm and terror, their imaginations filled with some great calamity, the form and dimensions of which nobody knew. Black it stood as night, fierce as 10 furies, terrible as hell. At a general court of the Bank of England held 2 days afterwards, the governor informed them of the several meetings that had been held on the affairs of the South Sea Company, adding that the directors had not yet thought fit to come to any decision upon the matter. A resolution was then proposed and carried without a dissentient voice, empowering the directors to agree with those of the South Sea to circulate their bonds, to what sum and upon what terms and for what time they might think proper. Thus both parties were at liberty to act as they might judge best for the public interest. Books were opened at the bank for a subscription of 3 millions for the support of public credit, on the usual terms of £15 per cent deposit, £3 per cent premium, and £5 per cent interest. So great was the concourse of people in the early part of the morning, all eagerly bringing their money, that it was thought the subscription would be filled that day. But before noon the tide turned. In spite of all that could be done to prevent it, the South Sea Company's stock fell rapidly. Their bonds were in such discredit that a run commenced upon the most eminent goldsmiths and bankers, some of whom, having lent out great sums upon South Sea stock, were obliged to shut up their shops and abscond. The Swordblade Company, who had hitherto been the chief cashiers of the South Sea Company, stopped payment. This being looked upon as but the beginning of evil, occasioned a great run upon the bank, who were now obliged to pay out money much faster than they had received it upon the subscription in the morning. The day succeeding was a holiday, the 29th of September, and the bank had a little breathing time. They bore up against the storm, but their former rivals, the South Sea Company, were wrecked upon it. Their stock fell to 150, and gradually, after various fluctuations, to 135. The bank, finding they were not able to restore public confidence and stem the tide of ruin without running the risk of being swept away with those they intended to save, declined to carry out the agreement into which they had partially entered. They were under no obligation whatever to continue, for the so-called bank contract was nothing more than the rough draft of an agreement in which blanks had been left for several important particulars and which contained no penalty for their secession. And thus, to use the words of the parliamentary history, were seen in the space of 8 months the rise, progress, and fall of that mighty fabric, which, being wound up by mysterious springs to a wonderful height, had fixed the eyes and expectations of all Europe, but whose foundation, being fraud, illusion, credulity, and infatuation, fell to the ground as soon as the artful management of its directors was discovered. In the heyday of its blood, during the progress of this dangerous delusion, the manners of the nation became sensibly corrupted. The parliamentary inquiry, set on foot to discover the delinquents, disclosed scenes of infamy, disgraceful alike to the morals of the offenders and the intellects of the people among whom they had arisen. It is a deeply interesting study to investigate all the evils that were the result. Nations, like individuals, cannot become desperate gamblers with impunity. Punishment is sure to overtake them sooner or later. A celebrated writer, Smollett, is quite wrong when he says that such an era as this is the most unfavorable for a historian, that no reader of sentiment and imagination can be entertained or interested by a detail of transactions such as these, which admit of no warmth, no coloring, no embellishment, a detail of which only serves to exhibit an inanimate picture of tasteless vice and mean degeneracy. On the contrary, and Smollett might have discovered it if he had been in the humor, the subject is capable of inspiring as much interest as even a novelist can desire. Is there no warmth in the despair of a plundered people, no life and animation in the picture which might be drawn of the woes of hundreds of impoverished and ruined families? Of the wealthy of yesterday become the beggars of today? Of the powerful and influential changed into exiles and outcasts, and the voice of self-reproach and imprecation resounding from every corner of the land? Is it a dull or uninstructive picture to see a whole people shaking suddenly off the trammels of reason and running wild after a golden vision, refusing obstinately to believe that it is not real till, like a deluded hind running after an ignis fatuus, they are plunged into a quagmire? But in this false spirit has history too often been written. The intrigues of unworthy courtiers to gain the favor of still more unworthy kings, or the records of murderous battles and sieges, have been dilated on and told over and over again with all the eloquence of style and all the charms of fancy. While the circumstances which have most deeply affected the morals and welfare of the people have been passed over with but slight notice, as dry and dull, and capable of neither warmth nor coloring. During the progress of this famous bubble, England presented a singular spectacle. The public mind was in a state of unwholesome fermentation. Men were no longer satisfied with the slow but sure profits of cautious industry. The hope of boundless wealth for the morrow made them heedless and extravagant for today. A luxury, till then unheard of, was introduced, bringing in its train a corresponding laxity of morals. The overbearing insolence of ignorant men who had arisen to sudden wealth by successful gambling made men of true gentility of mind and manners blush that gold should have power to raise the unworthy in the scale of society. The haughtiness of some of these ciphering cits, as they were termed by Sir Richard Steele, was remembered against them in the day of their adversity. In the parliamentary inquiry, many of the directors suffered more for their insolence than for their peculation. One of them, who in the full-blown pride of an ignorant rich man had said that he would feed his horse upon gold, was reduced almost to bread and water for himself. Every haughty look, every overbearing speech was set down and repaid them 100-fold in poverty and humiliation. The state of matters all over the country was so alarming that George I shortened his intended stay in Hanover and returned in all haste to England. He arrived on the 11th of November, and Parliament was summoned to meet on the 8th of December. In the meantime, public meetings were held in every considerable town of the empire, at which petitions were adopted, praying the vengeance of the legislature upon the South Sea directors, who by their fraudulent practices had brought the nation to the brink of ruin. Nobody seemed to imagine that the nation itself was as culpable as the South Sea Company. Nobody blamed the credulity and avarice of the people, the degrading lust of gain, which had swallowed up every nobler quality in the national character, or the infatuation which had made the multitude run their heads with such frantic eagerness into the net held out for them by scheming projectors. These things were never mentioned. The people were a simple, honest, hard-working people, ruined by a gang of robbers who were to be hanged, drawn, and quartered without mercy. This was the almost unanimous feeling of the country. The two houses of Parliament were not more reasonable. Before the guilt of the South Sea directors was known, punishment was the only cry. The king, in his speech from the throne, expressed his hope that they would remember that all their prudence, temper, and resolution were necessary to find out and apply the proper remedy for their misfortunes. In the debate on the answer to the address, several speakers indulged in the most violent invectives against the directors of the South Sea project. The Lord Molesworth was particularly vehement. It had been said by some that there was no law to punish the directors of the South Sea Company, who were justly looked upon as the authors of the present misfortunes of the state. In his opinion, they ought upon this occasion to follow the example of the ancient Romans, who, having no law against parricide because their legislators supposed no son could be so unnaturally wicked as to imbrue his hands in his father's blood, made a law to punish this heinous crime as soon as it was committed. They adjudged the guilty wretch to be sewn in a sack and thrown alive into the Tiber. He looked upon the contrivers and executors of the villainous South Sea scheme as the parricides of their country, and should be satisfied to see them tied in like manner in sacks and thrown into the Thames. Other members spoke with as much want of temper and discretion. Mr. Walpole was more moderate. He recommended that their first care should be to restore public credit. If the city of London were on fire, all wise men would aid in extinguishing the flames and preventing the spread of the conflagration before they inquired after the incendiaries. Public credit had received a dangerous wound and lay bleeding, and they ought to apply a speedy remedy to it. It was time enough to punish the assassin afterwards. On the 9th of December, an address in answer to His Majesty's speech was agreed upon after an amendment, which was carried without a division, that words should be added expressive of the determination of the House not only to seek a remedy for the national distresses, but to punish the authors of them. The inquiry proceeded rapidly. The directors were ordered to lay before the House a full account of all their proceedings. Resolutions were passed to the effect that the calamity was mainly owing to the vile arts of stockjobbers, and that nothing could tend more to the re-establishment of public credit than a law to prevent this infamous practice. Mr. Walpole then rose and said that, as he had previously hinted, he had spent some time upon a scheme for restoring public credit, but that the execution of it depending upon a position which had been laid down as fundamental, he thought it proper, before he opened out his scheme, to be informed whether he might rely upon that foundation. It was whether the subscription of public debts and encumbrances, money subscriptions and other contracts made with the South Sea Company, should remain in the present state. This question occasioned an animated debate. It was finally agreed by a majority of 259 against 117 that all these contracts should remain in their present state unless altered for the relief of the proprietors by a general court of the South Sea Company, or set aside by due course of law. On the following day, Mr. Walpole laid before a committee of the whole House his scheme for the restoration of public credit. which was, in substance, to engraft 9 millions of South Sea stock into the Bank of England, and the same sum into the East India Company upon certain conditions. The plan was favorably received by the House. After some few objections, it was ordered that proposals should be received from the two great corporations. They were both unwilling to lend their aid, and the plan met with a warm but fruitless opposition at the general courts summoned for the purpose of deliberating upon it. They, however, ultimately agreed upon the terms on which they would consent to circulate the South Sea bonds. And their report being presented to the committee, a bill was brought in under the superintendence of Mr. Walpole and safely carried through both houses of Parliament. A bill was at the same time brought in for restraining the South Sea directors, governor, sub-governor, treasurer, cashier, and clerks from leaving the kingdom for a 12-month, and for discovering their estates and effects, and preventing them from transporting or alienating the same. All the most influential members of the House supported the bill. Mr. Shippen, seeing Mr. Secretary Craggs in his place and believing the injurious rumors that were afloat of that minister's conduct on the South Sea business, determined to touch him to the quick. He said he was glad to see a British House of Commons resuming its pristine vigor and spirit, and acting with so much unanimity for the public good. It was necessary to secure the persons and estates of the South Sea directors and their officers, but, he added, looking fixedly at Mr. Craggs as he spoke, there were other men in high station whom, in time, he would not be afraid to name, who were no less guilty than the directors. Mr. Craggs arose in great wrath and said that if the innuendo were directed against him, he was ready to give satisfaction to any man who questioned him, either in the house or out of it. Loud cries of order immediately arose on every side. In the midst of the uproar, Lord Molesworth got up and expressed his wonder at the boldness of Mr. Craggs in challenging the whole House of Commons. He, Lord Molesworth, though somewhat old, past 60, would answer Mr. Craggs whatever he had to say in the House, and he trusted there were plenty of young men beside him who would not be afraid to look Mr. Craggs in the face out of the House. The cries of order again resounded from every side. The members arose simultaneously. Everybody seemed to be vociferating at once. The Speaker in vain called order. The confusion lasted several minutes, during which Lord Molesworth and Mr. Craggs were almost the only members who kept their seats. At last the call for Mr. Craggs became so violent that he thought proper to submit to the universal feeling of the House and explain his unparliamentary expression. He said that by giving satisfaction to the impugners of his conduct in that House, he did not mean that he would fight, but that he would explain his conduct. Here the matter ended, and the House proceeded to debate in what manner they should conduct their inquiry into the affairs of the South Sea Company, whether in a grand or a select committee. Ultimately, a secret committee of 13 was appointed, with power to send for persons, papers, and records. The Lords were as zealous and as hasty as the Commons. The Bishop of Rochester said the scheme had been like a pestilence. The Duke of Wharton said the House ought to show no respect of persons, that for his part he would give up the dearest friend he had if he had been engaged in the project. The nation had been plundered in a most shameful and flagrant manner, and he would go as far as anybody in the punishment of the offenders. Lord Stanhope said that every farthing possessed by the criminals, whether directors or not directors, ought to be confiscated to make good the public losses. During all this time, the public excitement was extreme. We learn from Cox's Walpole that the very name of a South Sea director was thought to be synonymous with every species of fraud and villainy. Petitions from counties, cities, and boroughs in all parts of the kingdom were presented, crying for the justice due to an injured nation and the punishment of the villainous peculators. Those moderate men who would not go to extreme lengths, even in the punishment of the guilty, were accused of being accomplices, were exposed to repeated insults and virulent invectives, and devoted both in anonymous letters and public writings to the speedy vengeance of an injured people. The accusations against Mr. Eilaby, Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Mr. Craggs, another member of the ministry, were so loud that the House of Lords resolved to proceed at once into the investigation concerning them. It was ordered on the 21st of January that all brokers concerned in the South Sea scheme should lay before the House an account of the stock or subscriptions bought or sold by them for any of the officers of the Treasury or Exchequer, or in trust for any of them, since Michaelmas 1719. When this account was delivered, it appeared that large quantities of stock had been transferred to the use of Mr. Eilaby. Five of the South Sea directors, including Mr. Edward Gibbon, the grandfather of the celebrated historian, were ordered into the custody of the Black Rod. Upon a motion made by Earl Stanhope, it was unanimously resolved that the taking in or giving credit for stock without a valuable consideration actually paid or sufficiently secured, or the purchasing stock by any director or agent of the South Sea Company for the use or benefit of any member of the administration, or any member of either House of Parliament during such time as the South Sea Bill was yet pending in Parliament, was a notorious and dangerous corruption. Another resolution was passed a few days afterwards, to the effect that several of the directors and officers of the company having, in a clandestine manner, sold their own stock to the company, had been guilty of a notorious fraud and breach of trust, and had thereby mainly caused the unhappy turn of affairs that had so much affected public credit. Mr. Eilaby resigned his office as Chancellor of the Exchequer and absented himself from Parliament until the formal inquiry into his individual guilt was brought under the consideration of the legislature. In the meantime, Knight, the treasurer of the company, and who was entrusted with all the dangerous secrets of the dishonest directors, packed up his books and documents, and made his escape from the country. He embarked in disguise in a small boat on the river, and proceeded to a vessel hired for the purpose, was safely conveyed to Calais. The Committee of Secrecy informed the House of the circumstance when it was resolved unanimously that two addresses should be presented to the King, the first praying that he would issue a proclamation offering a reward for the apprehension of Knight, and the second that he would give immediate orders to stop the ports and to take effectual care of the coasts to prevent the said Knight or any other officers of the South Sea Company from escaping out of the kingdom. The ink was hardly dry upon these addresses before they were carried to the King by Mr. Methuen, deputed by the House for that purpose. The same evening a royal proclamation was issued, offering a reward of £2,000 for the apprehension of Knight. The Commons ordered the doors of the House to be locked, and the keys to be placed on the table. General Ross, one of the members of the Committee of Secrecy, acquainted them that they had already discovered a train of the deepest villainy and fraud that hell had ever contrived to ruin a nation, which in due time they would lay before the House. In the meantime, in order to a further discovery, the committee thought it highly necessary to secure the persons of some of the directors and principal South Sea officers and to seize their papers. A motion to this effect having been made was carried unanimously. Sir Robert Chaplin, Sir Theodore Jansen, Mr. Sawbridge, and Mr. F. Isles, members of the House and directors of the South Sea Company, were summoned to appear in their places and answer for their corrupt practices. Sir Theodore Jansen and Mr. Sawbridge answered to their names and endeavored to exculpate themselves. The House heard them patiently and then ordered them to withdraw. A motion was then made and carried nemine contra dissenti that they had been guilty of a notorious breach of trust, had occasioned much loss to great numbers of His Majesty's subjects, and had highly prejudiced the public credit. It was then ordered that, for their offense, they should be expelled the House and taken into the custody of the sergeant-at-arms. Sir Robert Chaplin and Mr. Isles, attending in their places 4 days afterwards, were also expelled the House. It was resolved at the same time to address the King to give directions to his ministers at foreign courts to make application for Knight, that he might be delivered up to the English authorities in case he took refuge in any of their dominions. The King at once agreed, and messengers were dispatched to all parts of the continent the same night. Among the directors taken into custody were Sir John Blunt, the man whom popular opinion has generally accused of having been the original author and father of the scheme. This man, we are informed by Pope in his epistle to Alan Lord Bathurst, was a dissenter of a most religious deportment and professed to be a great believer. He constantly declaimed against the luxury and corruption of the age, the partiality of parliaments, and the misery of party spirit. He was particularly eloquent against avarice in great and noble persons. He was originally a scrivener, and afterwards became not only a director, but the most active manager of the South Sea Company. Whether it was during his career in this capacity that he first began to declaim against the avarice of the great, we are not informed. He certainly must have seen enough of it to justify his severest anathema. But if the preacher had himself been free from the vice he condemned, his declamations would have had a better effect. He was brought up in custody to the bar of the House of Lords and underwent a long examination. He refused to answer several important questions. He said he had been examined already by a committee of the House of Commons, and as he did not remember his answers and might contradict himself, he refused to answer before another tribunal. This declaration, in itself an indirect proof of guilt, occasioned some commotion in the House. He was again asked peremptorily whether he had ever sold any portion of the stock to any member of the administration or any member of either House of Parliament to facilitate the passing of the bill. He again declined to answer. He was anxious, he said, to treat the House with all possible respect, but he thought it hard to be compelled to accuse himself. After several ineffectual attempts to refresh his memory, he was directed to withdraw. A violent discussion ensued between the friends and opponents of the ministry. It was asserted that the administration were no strangers to the convenient taciturnity of Sir John Blunt. The Duke of Wharton made a reflection upon the Earl Stanhope, which the latter warmly resented. He spoke under great excitement and with such vehemence as to cause a sudden determination of blood to his head. He felt himself so ill that he was obliged to leave the House and retire to his chamber. He was cupped immediately, and also let blood on the following morning, but with slight relief. The fatal result was not anticipated. Towards evening he became drowsy, and turning himself on his face, expired. The sudden death of this statesman caused great grief to the nation. George I was exceedingly affected, and shut himself up for some hours in his closet, inconsolable for his loss. Knight, the treasurer of the company, was apprehended at Tirlemont, near Liège, by one of the secretaries of Mr. Leeds, the British resident at Brussels, and lodged in the citadel of Antwerp. Repeated applications were made to the court of Austria to deliver him up, but in vain. Knight threw himself upon the protection of the States of Brabant, and demanded to be tried in that country. It was a privilege granted to the States of Brabant by one of the articles of the Joyeuse Entrée that every criminal apprehended in that country should be tried in that country. The States insisted on their privilege and refused to deliver Knight to the British authorities. The latter did not cease their solicitations, but in the meantime Knight escaped from the citadel. On the 16th of February, the Committee of Secrecy made their first report to the House. They stated that their inquiry had been attended with numerous difficulties and embarrassments. Everyone they had examined had endeavored, as far as in him lay, to defeat the ends of justice. In some of the books produced before them, false and fictitious entries had been made. In others, there were entries of money with blanks for the name of the stockholders. There were frequent erasures and alterations, and in some of the books, leaves were torn out. They also found that some books of great importance had been destroyed altogether, and that some had been taken away or secreted. At the very entrance into their inquiry, they had observed that the matters referred to them were of great variety and extent. Many persons had been entrusted with various parts in the execution of the law, and under color thereof had acted in an unwarrantable manner in disposing of the properties of many thousands of persons, amounting to many millions of money. They discovered that before the South Sea Act was passed, there was an entry in the company's books of the sum of £1,259,325, upon account of stock stated to have been sold to the amount of £574,500. This stock was all fictitious, and had been disposed of with a view to promote the passing of the bill. It was noted as sold on various days and at various prices, from 150 to 325%. Being surprised to see so large an account disposed of at a time when the company was not empowered to increase their capital, the committee determined to investigate most carefully the whole transaction. The governor, sub-governor, and several directors were brought before them and examined rigidly. They found that at the time these entries were made, the company was not in possession of such a quantity of stock, having in their own right only a small quantity, not exceeding £30,000 at the utmost. Pursuing the inquiry, they found that this amount of stock was to be esteemed as taken in or holden by the company for the benefit of the pretended purchasers, although no mutual agreement was made for its delivery or acceptance at any certain time. No money was paid down, nor any deposit or security whatever given to the company by the supposed purchasers, so that if the stock had fallen, as might have been expected had the act not passed, they would have sustained no loss. If, on the contrary, the price of stock advanced, as it actually did by the success of the scheme, the difference by the advanced price was to be made good to them. Accordingly, after the passing of the act, the account of stock was made up and adjusted with Mr. Knight, and the pretended purchasers were paid the difference out of the company's cash. This fictitious stock, which had been chiefly at the disposal of Sir John Blunt, Mr. Gibbon, and Mr. Knight, was distributed among several members of the government and their connections, by way of bribe, to facilitate the passing of the bill. To the Earl of Sunderland was assigned £50,000 of this stock. To the Duchess of Kendal, £10,000. To the Countess of Platten, £10,000. To her two nieces, £10,000. To Mr. Secretary Craggs, £30,000. To Mr. Charles Stanhope, one of the Secretaries of the Treasury, £10,000. To the Sword Blade Company, £50,000. It also appeared that Mr. Stanhope had received the enormous sum of £250,000 as the difference in the price of some stock through the hands of Turner, Caswall & Company, but that his name had been partly erased from their books and altered to Stangape. Ileby, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, had made profits still more abominable. He had an account with the same firm, who were also South Sea directors, to the amount of £794,451. He had, besides, advised the company to make their second subscription 1.5 million instead of 1 million, by their own authority and without any warrant. The third subscription had been conducted in a manner as disgraceful. Mr. Ileby's name was down for £70,000, Mr. Craig's senior for £659,000, the Earl of Sunderland's for £160,000, and Mr. Stanhope for £47,000. This report was succeeded by six others, less important. At the end of the last, the committee declared that the absence of Knight, who had been principally entrusted, prevented them from carrying on their inquiries. The first report was ordered to be printed and taken into consideration on the next day but one succeeding. After a very angry and animated debate, a series of resolutions were agreed to, condemnatory of the conduct of the directors, of the members of the Parliament, and of the administration concerned with them, and declaring that they ought each and all to make satisfaction out of their own estates for the injury they had done the public. Their practices were declared to be corrupt, infamous, and dangerous, and a bill was ordered to be brought in for the relief of the unhappy sufferers. Mr. Charles Stanhope was the first person brought to account for his share in these transactions. He urged in his defense that for some years past he had lodged all the money he was possessed of in Mr. Knight's hands, and whatever stock Mr. Knight had taken in for him, he had paid a valuable consideration for it. As for the stock that had been bought for him by Turner, Caswell & Company, he knew nothing about it. Whatever had been done in that matter was done without his authority, and he could not be responsible for it. Turner and Company took the latter charge upon themselves, but it was notorious to every unbiased and unprejudiced person that Mr. Stanhope was a gainer of the £250,000 which lay in the hands of that firm to his credit. He was, however, acquitted by a majority of three only. The greatest exertions were made to screen him. Lord Stanhope, the son of the Earl of Chesterfield, went round to the wavering members, using all the eloquence he was possessed of, to induce them either to vote for the acquittal or to absent themselves from the House. Many weak-headed country gentlemen were led astray by his persuasions, and the result was as already stated. The acquittal caused the greatest disgust.